You know, there are all kinds of interesting people who live right around your neighborhood. Like, oh, the publicist, the rights distribution manager.
Would you look at that? It's people in your neighborhood on 95BFM, thanks to APRA MCOS NZ.
Oh, hi there.
Shh, listen.
Today, I'm feeling very honoured to have Matt Tanner, who is Head of Creative Services at Native Tongue Music Publishing. Now, you're based in Melbourne normally.
Yes.
But you've come to visit me.
I have. I'm still giggling about that last promo. I love it.
It's great, isn't it?
It's awesome.
Hey, can you tell us a little bit about Native Tongue Music Publishing to start
sure.
off
with? Sure. Well, I mean, I guess, do you want me to start with sort of generally what
publishers
do?
Yeah, what publishing
do? So, music publishers represent copyrights, compositions of their songwriters. Sometimes it's artists, sometimes it's just songwriters who aren't artists themselves. But we're charged with collecting income on the writers' behalfs when it's used commercially or broadcast on radio or live performance. And then also sort of pitching for placement in TV and film and advertising. That's the really short version of what a publisher does.
Yep.
And then Native Tongue Music Publishing is an independent publisher, started in 2003, so sort of we're 17 years in now. And we work in Melbourne and Sydney and Auckland. Our writers are sort of dotted all around the world, and we have partners in most territories in the world that we work with. They're our sub-publishers, so they look after our catalogues internationally, and in turn we look after a lot of those catalogues for Australia and New Zealand.
Oh, cool. So I guess to clarify, publishing is the copyright for the written song.
The written part, as opposed to the audio recording, which is usually referred to as the master.
Yep. Mm. So Native Tongue looks after the written song, which
yes.
includes the music and the lyrics.
Yes.
Yep. And as Head of Creative Services, what is your role within the company?
My role covers a few areas. So, but generally speaking, it's growing our catalogue, growing our Native Tongue music publishing catalogues, identifying new writers and new talent, and sometimes they're a long way down the track already in terms of what they're doing with their writing or their artist career, and then sometimes we're looking at talent who may take a number of years to develop. So we think there's a raw talent there, and we'll start working with them and develop them sort of into or down whatever path they're looking to go.
So how do you do that? How do you get someone who's like, I don't know, fresh out of music school or mm-hmm. fresh out, like off the scene and
yep.
develop them? How do you kind of take them and mould them?
It's very much a writer-by-writer case. So we've had writers that have basically only ever done anything in their bedroom, but maybe their production, their writing or their songwriting ability is really, there's some really amazing raw talent there. So we might try and work out what avenue they're trying to travel. Some are looking to head down a pop pathway. Some are looking to, a really indie sort of pathway. Some are really looking to collaborate with other people. Some are really quite comfortable just, doing their own thing, just writing for themselves. And case by case, we work out what that pathway might be. I guess as an example, we signed a young writer from Perth about 12 months ago who was really focused on, who really just wanted to write for K-pop, wasn't really interested in anything else, was a K-pop, I wouldn't say a diehard, had initially been into pop but discovered K-pop and really found it a good fit for them. And I guess we've opened up the doorways, the pathways for that writer to spend a fair bit of time in Korea and Japan writing K-pop and J-pop. He has a couple of cuts now and a whole bunch more on a hold. So, we found that drive was there to for him, that he really wanted to head that way. And we put the stepping stones in place for him to do that.
Yeah. So can you explain for the audience how that comes to be? So you've got a person who really wants to write a song for K-pop.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do they know what to write, and what's the process in doing that?
Mm. Well, I mean, K-pop's a good example of really having to have your head in that space. So we've had through our partners in Korea and J-pop in Japan, our partners have sent us briefs for several years, and we've tried to field those briefs and send back tracks that I mean, it's got a lot to do with how that industry works. So artists are never really involved in the material that they perform. It's all basically given to them. The A&Rs say, great, this is the song we're picking. Then the artist learns that song and they perform it and they make videos and they release it on record, which is a very different case to, you know, pop here in New Zealand and in Australia and to a large degree in the US and the UK, where often artists will be involved in the writing of songs. So there's really... with K-pop and J-pop, it's very very strict in terms of the boundaries that they're working and they're writing in it. And the A&Rs are very hot and cold. They like this, they don't like that, and then it's not uncommon for them to take parts from three or four different songs and put them together like a Frankenstein song.
Yeah,
and that becomes a K-pop song.
Can you what is an A&R, just for people who don't
artists
know?
And repertoire.
Yeah,
so it's usually a position in a record label or a publisher, and their job is to sign artists and find repertoire. So,
right.
I guess in a traditional sense, the A&R person had artists and they matched the repertoire up
The artists,
which is the song.
So, yep.
And that's where publishers came in. So traditionally, publishers would have songwriters who wrote songs and they'd pitch them to the A&R at the record labels, and the A&Rs would pick certain songs to work to match their artists.
Right.
So, and really prior to the Beatles, most big pop artists didn't write their own songs. The Beatles were sort of the first ones.
So, like Elvis would be an example?
Elvis had shares on a lot of his songs, but
but
he really didn't write a lot of his own songs. He got writing shares on songs because he was Elvis.
Yep.
and Elvis could kind of demand that he had shares. But the Beatles were the first real example of, you know, all of their repertoire they wrote themselves. Since then there's always a number of pop artists that will take songs or take cuts, as we call it, from other writers, and sometimes, you know, a lot of the time these days, like Elvis, artists will say, well, I'm going to cut this song, so I want to share, you know, and it might be, yeah, you know, a very small share, and they may change a token word to justify getting a share, but a lot of artists these days are involved in the writing.
Right. So this is kind of like when Lizzo got some people kind of went to her with legal issues because they said that they had coined a phrase, which I can't remember.
Yeah.
So they were seeking royalties on the publishing of writing that song.
There's, I mean, that's a whole new industry in the pop world is, I think, you know, for a lot of times, a lot of years, an artist would say, oh, someone's lifted part of my song, engage a lawyer. The lawyer would email and say, hey, we think they've used this, you know, part of this song, and they'll come to some sort of arrangement, or it might get to court. But for a long time, there was only a few lawyers who specialised in that area. But now there's, you know, in the last 3 or 4 years, it's become a whole industry, and I'm getting a little bit off track here, but a whole industry of lawyers who are actively out there looking for ways to, you know, without even direction from another artist, but going, oh, we think this song's lifted a little bit of this song. So they'll go to the original writer and say, hey, we think pop artist A has lifted this part of your song. Do you want us to chase it down? We think it could be worth it. You know, it's like those have you had a fall at work type lawyers, you know, call us and we'll get you a payout. So now, I mean, something is starting to trend in the US is songwriter insurance. So songwriters are paying thousands of dollars a year to insure themselves from someone coming after them for a song that they've written.
Gosh, that's crazy.
It is crazy.
Yeah.
It's not great. It's not a great part of the not a great new part of the industry at all.
No, not at all. So if you have just tuned in, we're talking to Matt Tanner, who is Head of Creative Services at Native Tongue Music Publishing. If we go back to K-pop, mm-hmm. can you, I know I've seen a brief, but can you give us a roundabout idea of what that brief looks like? I think the brief I saw might have been for a whole album, and mm-hmm. it had maybe 13 songs on it and kind of described the different sounds that they wanted.
Yeah, and a lot of those sounds will be different sounds that they want in a single song. So they're very detailed.
Oh, wow. So it might just be 13 points where... Because when you listen to K-pop, it's not just what I think is a traditional song. There always seems to be like... They kind of just go in different tangents and then come back
again. Very, very technical, and parts are... and that's how they can be sort of... They can construct a song with that sort of Frankenstein... type idea where they'll say the bridge in this is great but we don't like the rest of the song, or the pre-chorus in this song's great but you need to change the hook from 24 to 26 seconds, and really very, very minute detail in terms of what they want and the sounds that they want. And often whole projects are already mapped out for an artist, and then the A&Rs at the labels are just putting the parts together to make up a project.
Because I think you've told me before, like, some of the K-pop artists have management teams that are like 120 managers or something.
Well, Jamie Goff, who's the general manager at Native Tongue, and myself visited Seoul probably nearly 2 years ago now, and this is when BTS was like exploding across the world, and their management company is called Big Hit, and we visited Big Hit. And at that time, they had, that management company, their only artist was BTS.
Wow.
They had a couple of other artists in development that had nothing out at that stage. And they had, I think it was 245 employees at a management company for a single artist. But at that time, BTS had sold out Shea Stadium in New York in 5 minutes. So they were massive. And then I visited again in November last year, and they'd increased their staff to over 500.
Wow, for one band.
For one band. I mean, they got a couple of little developing projects now, but
So one it's band obviously brings in making a lot of
95% of the money. Yeah.
Yeah. And when the writer gets a cut as such, mm-hmm. could that just be part of a song?
Yeah, it could be just a part of a song. Yeah. So if they decide that they've got, let's say, they're going to put two parts together and each song has three or four writers, that song may end up with seven writers. And then often when we get a cut in Korea, the translator will get, 12.5% of the writing to translate the lyrics.
Oh, wow.
Sometimes they're completely rewriting the lyrics and they may just keep some sort of keywords. So in that case, you may end up with eight writers on a track, which is not particularly unusual in that world.
Yeah. Can you talk to us about Stu Crichton?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So Stu was a writer who has had sort of, I guess, three stages of his career as an artist and as a writer. And he started. He's Scottish and had a career in the sort of early dance era, the 90s in the UK, and had writing credits with like. Kylie Minogue and Elton John and bits and pieces, not bits and pieces, they were really big deals.
Yeah.
and then in the early 2000s, he moved to Australia and I guess really kind of was doing a lot of the pop writing in Australia. So, I guess I'm not sure if these names would translate, but like Guy Sebastian and Delta Goodrum and Jess Malboy we don't have a particularly strong domestic pop market in Australia. So he was doing all that writing, but I think after 4 or 5 years or 6 years, it became far less of a challenge for him. So he, around about 2015, he moved to LA to embark on his writing career, probably the third stage of his writing career in the US and in the pop market. And, you know, a few years of really hard work, and he's, you know, he's got new cuts or, you know, writing credits on albums all over the world now. So he's really sort of hitting a purple patch of writing in what's probably his third decade of songwriting. So he's got cuts in the last 6 months on the Kesha record, Chainsmokers, Robin Schultz, Louis Tomlinson from One Direction. He has cuts coming up with Sigala and Tiesto, and so and when now that that's happened, there's not a lot that we have to do creatively because people are just knocking on his door and his manager's door, you know, every day. So yeah. It's a matter of for him just to fit things in. He works really hard, and he's also a great producer, so he's getting production on a lot of those tracks as well.
Oh, wow, that's really cool. And how did you end up at Native Tongue?
I had been interested in music from school, and I grew up in a relatively regional town in Victoria, in Australia. And I never thought, you know, I used to travel to all ages shows in Melbourne, and always wanted those shows to be in my hometown. I think it was 18, 19, I put on, you know, a couple of all-ages shows, you know, borrowed some money from mum and dad to
so
do
cool.
it.
Yeah.
And then I moved overseas. I tour managed for several years, and I came back and was promoting international tours in Australia, quite naively, I think, in my early 20s. The first couple I did, I made money and I thought, great, this is easy, this is what I'm going to do. And then the next one I lost all of that and more. And and after a couple more years, I think the white-knuckle nature of promoting and wasn't my cup of tea. But I got into, again, like a lot of managers, I accidentally fell into management. I managed a couple of bands who I'd booked on tours. And I think at that stage, you know, all of my musical decisions were based on what I liked. I liked this band, so I'll work with them. And I started a record label. My wife and I started a record label, and we ran that for 10 years. And all the time I was managing. And then I did some project management work for Native Tongue in the late 2000s. And Chris Goff, who is the boss at Native Tongue, he was, you know, doing some touring for Native Tongue artists, and I was sort of helping put the tours together and putting the releases together. And then a position came up for the A&R, and Chris said to me, are you interested? And I said, absolutely. It was, I think it was the first time in music over, probably the best part of 18 or 20 years then that I'd received a paycheck for working in music, so it was quite nice.
Yeah,
it was quite nice for that to have that. And so that's been like 10 years next month.
Yeah,
I've been at Native Tongue, and finally felt like that I'd found the part of the music industry that fit me so well. Management I really enjoyed, but it was really 24/7, and I only got to work with three or four acts at a time, you know, and do. And what I thought was a good job. But in publishing, I was able to work on a creative level with like literally dozens of artists. So that was creatively really fulfilling for me. And I felt like I had a lot to offer artists in helping them creatively. So it's yep. been it was a long journey to get to the perfect spot for myself. But
What do you think you like best about the role?
I think it's just being able to work with a whole lot of artists in a whole lot of different areas. You know, I love working with the indie guys, the indie artists who are just writing a record and releasing a record and touring a record and then, you know, rinse and repeat. The way that they kind of go about their business, and they're so passionate about what they do. I like working with writers who were artists and transitioned into writers. Perhaps they're writing for other people, or they're transitioning into like film composition or score. And I really like working with the writer-producers who are just working on a whole range of different projects. It was interesting that the switch from management, like an artist manager, to publishing. The big thing I noticed initially was a lot of managers are sort of friendly with each other, but they don't sort of reveal a whole lot about, you know, what they're working on or what's coming up, or there's not a lot of, managers tend to keep their, not secrets, but their tools fairly closed off.
Yeah.
As soon as I started working at Native Tongue, all the managers, and I've, you know a whole lot of managers, but all of a sudden those managers were quite comfortable telling me about their artists and their business and what they're up to. So it was kind of like I'd switch sides, and then I was fine to confide in or talk to.
Yeah, because I guess like you like can put different artists together now, like, and it's not kind of limiting or anything.
That's
like
right.
That.
So yep. You know, and we'll speak to our writers and say, who do you want to work with? And they'll often have a list of, I'd love to write with these people. And I can often quickly look down the list and say, well, they only do their own, they write for themselves, that's it. They don't have any external writers. These people definitely do, so we'll get in touch with managers or the label. And sometimes, you know, I actually find, and it sounds a little bit like I'm passing the buck when I say this, but for a lot of artists, the most direct pathway is artist to artist, and artists really don't mind other artists reaching out on, you know, Instagram message, for example. So many sessions get set up because an artist has reached out to another artist.
Yeah.
Whereas if I reach out to a manager or a label who has to speak to a manager who has to then speak to the artist, there's always hurdles put in place. Just that's how it is. But artist to artist is always the most direct and usually the most successful way of connecting with another artist. So hot tip.
Yeah. And you have writers' rooms in Melbourne?
Yes.
And
Sydney?
Yep. And LA?
And LA, yes.
Yep.
So I guess when going back sort of 10 years, Native Tongue, we didn't have a lot of writers who were just writing for other people. So it was predominantly artists doing their artist thing. I could see that there was, other publishers were developing writers, and obviously there was writers who were doing really well in pop that I knew weren't artists themselves. So we set about developing that kind of, those sort of writers and identifying those sort of writers. But part of that bigger picture build was getting our own writers to start collaborating quite early on. So we set up writing camps, and in hindsight, the first one went for 10 days long and was on a beach with a garage full of Corona that Cronus gave. So it was a wild swing of an effort, but it's developed significantly since then. But it's a really important part of our business is getting our own catalogue to collaborate and write together and develop writing skills and develop their co-writing skills. And as an extension of that, year round, the writers' rooms are really important for our writers just to come through and write. So they'll just sort of say, hey, I've got a session with such and such. And then kind of going back to that idea of reaching out to an artist somehow, and you know, whether it be via DM or email, and saying, hey, let's write together. So we have those facilities that then those writers can come and use the rooms. And for us, it's great to have our writers and artists in the building, and we get to see them a little more regularly and have a coffee with them and talk about what's going on. So on several levels, it's really great to have the writing rooms for our writers.
Yeah. Are you able to tell the listeners some of the artists that you look after?
Yes. Jin Wigmore, Delaney Davidson. I'm starting with New Zealand writers,
yep.
Tammy Nielsen. And then writers like Stu Crichton and Con Kersting, who's having a really wild moment with Tones and I, Dance Monkey. Looks like it's a top five track in the US at the moment and still going. So a lot happening for Con at the moment. Tim Tan, who's doing a lot in Korea and Japan. Con, just giving back to Con Kersing, he sort of spent a fair bit of time in Stockholm over the last year, doing his, you know, honing riding and doing a lot of sessions, and had, you know, not by his choice, a lot of sessions for Eurovision tracks, which is an industry in itself in Europe. We look after bands like Kingswood and it's me trying to remember bands.
Straight Jacket Fits. Shankata.
Yes, Jess B.
Marlon Williams.
Yes, thank you.
Dave Dobbin.
Thank you very much. So we really bridge a broad spectrum of artists and writers, and it's really quite interesting which writers can segue into a sort of a writing career. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool. Thank you so much, Matt, for coming up.
Oh, pleasure.
So we've been talking to Matt Tanner, who's the head of creative services at Native Tongue Music Publishing. He looks after the A&R and all the kind of putting all the writers and artists together so that they can write amazing songs.
Bit of matchmaking.
Yeah, a bit of matchmaking. It is kind of a marriage, isn't it?
It is. Well, that's actually, I'm still talking, sorry. A great part of is when you match a couple of writers up for the first time and then they go on to do a whole lot of writing together over a number of years, that's super satisfying.
Yeah, I'll bet. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Another friendly face to make life a little richer. People in your neighbourhood on 95BFM. Thanks to APRA AMCOS NZ.